Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. And it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Michal Maiden, who's Director of the Gas and the China Programmes at the OIS, and Baifa Zhang, who is Senior Policy Advisor at E3G's Climate Diplomacy Team. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from the article, Will China's Power Crunch Shift Its Climate Policy?, that was published in the OIES's March 2022 Oxford Energy Forum, or OEF. Now, in this ever-changing market, I'd like to timestamp this podcast recording, if I may, and we're recording it on the morning of Tuesday, the 28th of June, 2022. Michal and Byford, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Hi, David. It's great to be back.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Byford, can I start with you? The OIEF discussed the reasons behind the implications of China's energy crisis in 2021. Now, there was much debated discussion as to whether China's effort to curb emissions was behind the outages, provinces shutting down operations in order to meet emissions reductions targets. So, Byford, my question is, in your understanding, was climate policy behind the outages?
Yeah, so I think to answer this question, first we have to look at the main policies that were put in place to govern local energy use in different provinces. So there are mainly two policies. The first one is the double energy targets. So that's the total consumption and the energy intensity targets, commonly known as the double control targets in China. And then second, there is the carbon intensity target as part of the five-year plan. So every province is also given this target, and they don't have to meet it by the end of the five-year plan. So every 5 years, they get adjudicated on this. So these targets are not new. So when we look at the energy target, the double energy target, they have been introduced since 2016, long before China has put in place any ambitious new carbon neutrality targets. And every year, local government is given this target they need to meet. And the targets that were set for provinces in 2021, the year of the power crunch, were similar to the ones that was given in the previous year. So there's no immediate pressure to meet these targets. But then 2021 was indeed a challenging year for some of these local governments because the economy came roaring back after a year of COVID. And then a lot of international buyers turned to China to mitigate disruption of supply chains in countries that are still fighting with COVID in 2021. And China has came roaring back. And the growth in domestic consumption, the less energy intensive part of the economy, remains sluggish since the COVID outbreak in China. So those two factors have made local governments harder to meet these targets. So for the first half of the year, then more than a third of provinces in China are not on track to meet their energy intensity targets. And some provinces proceed to ration their power in order to meet those targets. So I would say that it's a driver in those targets, but they're not given particularly hard targets to meet. And then the other target that I talked about, the five-year plan carbon intensity target, they're not necessary to meet that towards the end of 2025, which is 4 years from now. So there's no immediate pressure for the government to meet these targets. So it's a driver, but I wouldn't say it's the main factor in causing the power crunch.
Okay, I hear that. So how have the government measures to deal with the crisis impacted on China's climate policy then?
Yeah, so the government has taken a number of measures to mitigate these impacts that have an impact on climate policy. The main one is the reform of coal power pricing, which tackles the root cause of the crisis, which is the pricing signals, which led to a mismatch of supply and demand, and is likely to be consequential in driving China's energy transition. So all coal power utilities are now required to sell their power through the wholesale market with no price guarantee, which was the case before. And generators are allowed to pass through some of the cost to commercial and industrial user and set price within like a 20% plus or minus band anchored to a base price. So which means that coal generators, unlike during the onset of the power crunch, they do not need to operate at loss at times in response to high fuel prices. And this should make coal less competitive to against renewable energy over the long term. The reform system means that market players are less exposed to uncertainties in the market with regulated electricity pricing, but market-based coal prices. And then the government has also taken some administrative and fiscal measures to boost coal supply. So they have introduced a 200 billion yuan lending program from the central bank to boost the clean and efficient production of coal. So projects such as coal plants retrofitting, industrial boiler upgrades, coal washing are all eligible for the funding. The government has just added about 100 billion yuan to this program, I think, 2 months ago. So that's one of the fiscal measures, an administrative measure. The other one is the new funding program on clean coal, which was also launched side by side with the low-cost loan program on clean coal. So the other administrative measure the government has put in place, a fiscal measure that has put in place, is also a new funding program on clean energy, which was launched side by side on the program on clean coal, which will support programs going into low carbon projects, including installation of renewable energy, smart grids, and carbon capture technology. So overall, these measures have led to some of the policies that are likely to boost coal production in the short term and support new capacities that are at risk of being stranded. So in this context, it has also strengthened the space for discussion around raising ambitions in China's climate targets. So that's the bad news. But the good news is China has not backtracked on its renewable energy targets and is still expected to double its renewable energy capacity by 2025 and to overachieve its 2030 targets on renewable capacity. So it has also sparked more discussion around the need to speed up reform in the power market. For example, creating a unified power market nationally and creating incentives for maintaining power capacity on reserve.
Okay, you mentioned coals. I'd like to take our discussion there, if I can, for a few minutes, because you know there is now considerable focus on coal fire capacity additions in China, which you know have increased following the power crisis. And so I expect my question is, has the Russian invasion of Ukraine impacted the government's thinking? You know, do you think this has reinforced existing trends or perhaps changed the government's thinking?
Yeah, so I would say mainly is a continuation of existing trends. Since the power crunch last year, Chinese leaders struck a more cautious tone when referencing to climate policy. So highlighting the need to safeguard the security aspect of the energy and climate transition and have introduced a series of measures to boost clean coal, as we discussed. And the need to increase the supply of coal was made an economic priority for 2022, with 22 provinces introduced policy, and that is before the war, to expand coal production to boost capacity by about 300 million tons, which is roughly the amount of coal China imported in 2021. So potentially a sign that Beijing is aiming to further wean off imports, given the uncertainty of COVID, but also the geopolitics. So so the volatility caused by the in the fossil markets caused by the war and the fraught geopolitical relationship with the West, I think it's likely to elevate energy security considerations in policymakers' mind in Beijing.
Now, in your March 2022 article that I referred to earlier on, you noted a few points that readers should look out for, which included the 14th five-year plan documents and the build-out of new coal capacity. So what has changed or not changed, do you think, since you wrote that article?
Yeah, so since I've written the article in February, a key policy document has dropped, which is the 14th five-year plan on modern energy system. I know that Mikhail is going to expand on this in a moment, but so there wasn't any major surprises, I would say, but I think there are a few things that are worth highlighting. So the first one is in this new five-year plan compared to the last one, which was like more than 6 years ago, the plan has dropped a target on coal in the share of power mix and introduced a share of non-fossil fuel in the power mix, which is 39%. Probably reflective on the uncertainty around the trajectory on coal. So it's much, much harder to predict the trajectory now given the energy security concerns. Second, there's an introduction of quantified targets on retrofitting coal power plants to make them more flexible. So this is key in transforming coal as a base load power source to a supportive power source, which I think Mikhail is going to touch upon later on. And the name of the plan has also changed from the last time. The last time, the main plan on energy is called the Energy Development 5-Year Plan, but this time it's called a 5-Year Plan on Modern Energy System. So I think that reflects the need for more integration between different energy sources, different regions, and different energy strategic objectives, which is necessary as renewable energy takes a more prominent role in the power system.
Yeah, but as we know the world over, you change the name of a policy, it has huge impacts, everything's all right. Well, look, Mika, I wanted to come to you. You know, Byford's giving you a kind of real build-up on what you're going to talk about. So, you know, let me ask you, has the kind of both the power crisis last year and the invasion of Ukraine by Russia impacted on the Chinese government's view of energy security?
And I think it's important to stress here, and perhaps it's a little bit different to what's going on in the West, where energy security has really risen on the policy agenda, that all of these global and domestic energy shocks in China have combined to inform policymaking. So in that sense, this is a much longer process. The Russian invasion, I agree with Byford, is not a game changer, but actually a reinforcer and accelerator of many existing trends. I think there are some changes in nuance in thinking on energy security. I'll come back to those in a minute. But in terms of the reinforcing trends, this issue of energy security has been rising on the policy agenda for, there's a very notable starting point in October 2019 when Li Keqiang, when Premier Li Keqiang talks about it, but it can be traced back to sort of the US-China trade war, to concern about China's role in global supply chains after COVID, the power outages, now the Russian invasion of Ukraine. All of these highlight the kind of national security concerns around energy, the geopolitical tensions that Byford has just talked about. So, you know, in that context, it's been sort of building up and energy security has been rising on the agenda. But I think it's interesting to know, we highlight this in the OEF as well, that China's energy insecurities in the past and any physical shortages that it's faced with energies have not stemmed from international actions, but actually from domestic policies. And Byford talked about it earlier, about the mismatch between prices. US sanctions on Iran and Venezuela have complicated oil flows in the past, and as have sanctions on Russia now. They have not stopped flows of energy to China, but of course, perceptions are still extremely important. And that's, you know, we're getting, a culmination of perceptions about these concerns on energy security. The focus is very much on domestic supplies, on resource availability, oil, gas, coal. But interestingly, I think that renewables are also starting to make their way into the narrative as a source of energy security. And that is, they weren't in the past. I think it was very interesting that there wasn't sort of a very active lobby or anybody advocating renewables in China as a source of energy security. But I think that is starting to become more prominent now as China looks to sort of securing its needs through its own resources and not just the fossil fuel resources. And that, I think, is significant for the energy transition.
Okay, but that said, do you think that coal is making a comeback?
Coal is certainly rising strongly. There's been a large number of new coal-fired power plant approvals this year. Coal demand has grown massively. The BP statistical review was actually published this morning. It shows that coal consumption in China rose by close to 5% year on year in 2021. That has reversed. Sort of, we've all been talking about coal demand in China peaking in 2013, 2014. That has now reversed. This is the first time that we're actually getting coal demand that is higher than those peak levels. So yes, it's making a comeback, but it's, again, it's a gradual comeback that has been happening for several years. It's not a result of the power crisis. It's not a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, even though the power outages, again, as Byford discussed, have clearly spurred more output and consumption, perhaps also in order to displace some of the import dependence. But really, the strong post-COVID-19 economic growth momentum has hugely contributed to coal, because we have to remember that coal is the backbone of China's energy system, and perhaps more importantly, of its political economy. And while it will be phased out, the government has said that in the 15th five-year plan, which is sort of after 2025, coal will peak. It will take time, and we still don't know at which levels coal demand will peak. The 14th five-year plan does highlight this importance of coal as a backbone, but it also maintains this commitment to growing renewables, which again, Byford just talked about. So both elements are on the table.
Okay, Mika, I'll come back in a minute and talk about the 14 five-year plan documents. Before that, I'd like to ask Byford, you know, how do you think the coal versus renewables in the context of energy security, how do you think that ranks up in China's energy priorities?
Yeah, so, I mean, Beijing policymakers has always stressed that, like, China's resource endowment is coal-dominated. So when they talk about energy or even climate policy these days, so that is the starting point. And coal is the most abundant fossil fuel in China. So coal will always be the default fallback option for Chinese policymakers in securing the country's energy needs. But it is not the only abundant energy source, because renewable energy like solar and wind is actually readily available. But the challenge is, how do we bring them online? So at the same time, the policymakers also recognize the role of coal is changing. So in the five-year plan that I just touched upon, the new one on energy system, they have said that coal is going to shift into a more supportive role, transitioning existing plants from serving baseload and becoming more supportive power source when other sources are not available, like renewable energy sources, when they cannot deliver the full power demand. So, but in order to enable that transition of coal plants' role, we would need to retrofit them to allow them to run efficiently with a lower load, to make them to start up quickly to fill contingency demands. And also there are reforms needed in the power market so that the financial incentives are provided for them to keep these plants' supportive capacities more profitable. So more reforms of this kind would allow China to phase down coal and let renewable to play a more prominent role in securing the country's energy security.
Okay, Mikhail, well, let me come back to you, if I may, to pick up on the kind of the 14th five-year plan. Now, how has the energy crisis in China and subsequent events been reflected in that? And also, you know, picking up on the coal discussion, you know, Can you use coal-fired power plants as flexible capacity?
I mean, why don't we start with the coal bit? Because really, the plan does talk about using coal to provide peak regulation services for renewable power. Byford just mentioned all the plans. From an economic perspective, I'm not convinced that it makes sense, right? This results in more coal consumption per unit of electricity. It goes back to what we were saying from a political economy perspective. It certainly makes sense because this is a way for provinces to generate growth, to generate reliable supplies and energy security. But it is an open question of whether these plants that are built arguably for peak will actually be used as baseload. You know, there isn't that much discussion about stranded assets sort of when thinking about all these new capacity additions that are coming online in China. But equally, when you talk about phasing out existing coal-fired power plants, you will get lots of experts in China saying, but actually the average kind of the median life of these coal-fired power plants is sort of 12 to 15 years. They're all really young and recent, so we can't phase them out in order not to create stranded assets. I mean, the point is here, this is a way to prolong the life of coal. It is a way to potentially support renewables, but this is also a huge risk of carbon lock-in and creating stranded assets going forward. But I think this goes to that point of the 14 five-year plan and how the energy crisis and all these events are reflecting in the thinking. Again, we have to bear in mind it's not isolated to what happened last year in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Plans take a long time to be drafted and drawn up. But the prominence of energy security is a huge factor here, the issue of coal, and coal is kind of the baseload and the mainstay. But as I think there is a paradigm shift, and as Byford mentioned, the name of the plan for a modern energy system, is reflective of the importance of the 2030-2060 targets, namely to reach peak emissions before 2030 and to reach carbon neutrality by 2060. Some of the targets are vaguer. Now, this might be events that have meant that the government has had to water down or maybe take out targets because there's just no way of knowing what you can realistically reach. I think it is also because the five-year plan is different in tone. It is really about a system-wide change, laying the foundations for a new energy system, which is more holistic, more efficient, digital, fit for integrating more renewables. And it's interesting that the five-year plan talks about this international context, and it talks about sort of volatile geopolitics. Unlike previous five-year plans that talked about oil and gas insecurity, here the kind of geopolitical volatility is the fact that the world is moving towards an energy transition. And so, again, it is all about making a system that will be better for integrating renewables and shifting China towards its energy transition goals.
Okay, but quickly, you know, what about the role of gas, you know, in China's energy mix, which we haven't really discussed on this podcast so far?
I mean, gas obviously still has a role to play, but we have to remember gas is less than 9% of China's energy mix. And at the peak in 2030, it is unlikely to exceed 15%. Now, in the world that we are living in today, it might actually be a peak of 12 or 13% of the energy mix. That's still a chunk of arguably 200 or even 300 BCM of incremental gas demand through 2030. But whether it will be 200 or 300, I think recent events suggest that we are leaning towards 200 BCM rather than 300, and that sort of this use of flexible coal actually reduces the potential role of gas as a source of flexibility in the power sector. Add on to that the geopolitics of supply, and they are complicated. If we look forward at China's gas supplies, obviously pipelines are overwhelmingly going to come from Russia, especially if there's a power of Siberia too. But if we look at LNG markets, the main suppliers are the US, Australia, Qatar, and Russia. Geopolitically, that's extremely complicated. And again, I think that reinforces potentially the role of coal.
Yeah, two things there. Interestingly, of course, just these numbers flow off the tongue, which just shows the huge size, of course, of the China energy system we're talking about. And secondly, you mentioned those LNG suppliers, large LNG suppliers. Of course, a lot of other countries, Europe included, who will be looking for those supplies as well. Well, Bhavit, I'd like to come to you, if I can, for the last question. As our listeners know, you know, I always like to kind of do a forward-looking question at the end of each podcast. So can I perhaps ask you, you know, what do you think we can expect from China at COP27 in November 22?
Yeah, sure. So Chinese officials have stressed that in various occasions that the focus of COP27 in Egypt should be on implementation, so that countries should get on with the delivery of their climate targets instead of focusing on raising ambitions of their targets. So based on this and the policy context that we just discussed, I think it's unlikely that China is going to bring any major updates to its climate and energy targets to this COP in Egypt. But at the same time, China has made a pledge alongside with 197 countries in the last COP in Glasgow last year to revisit and strengthen the 2030 targets in alignment with the Paris Agreement temperature goal by the end of this year, so by the end of 2022. So my sense is that China is likely to bring in some of these sectoral targets that has been published in the new five-year plans to the COP27 to fulfill these pledges. And finally, specifically on coal. So there is a whole no new coal movement that has picked up last year internationally, with more than 60 countries committing to stop building new coal power in their country. So major coal users in the developing world, including China's neighbors like Vietnam and Indonesia, have made strong commitments to phase out coal at the last COP. So there are also ongoing discussions between the G7 countries and some developing countries regarding just energy transition partnerships, similar to the one that has been agreed with South Africa last year, where developed countries will be financing the transition and the phase down of coal in South Africa. So these new deals may enable more developing countries to make commitments to phase out coal. So no matter what China does at COP, it's likely to be faced with this contact whereby more of its neighbors and developing countries' counterparts will have made more ambitious commitments on phasing down coal compared to China. So China will perhaps be under slightly more pressure to end the construction of new coal power plants in its borders and also put an expiry date on coal on its power system.
Well, thank you, Bai, for that insight. And of course, we at the Institute will be following closely the run-up to the COP27 conference through our energy transition program and indeed through our gas and electricity and oil programs. Well, look, Mikael and Bai, thank you so much for your time today. You know, as always, and I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the messages from your article, Will China's Power Crunch shift its climate policy that was published in the OIES March 2022 Oxford Energy Forum publication. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.